This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Welcome back to another episode of the GBH Collective, where we bring you the stories behind the stories from our writers and photographers all over the world, and from our studio team based right here in Chicago. This is all made possible by our subscribers and underwriters. Guinness is helping us bring you a completely new series of stories called Coming to America, featuring upstart and iconic breweries from around the world who are trying to make their way in the U.S. in the age of local. As part of the Guinness Coming to America section, we'll be featuring new wave breweries as well as long-standing imports like this month's focus on Brasserie du Bessin, a Belgian brewery older than Belgium itself. And we've just taken on New Belgium as an underwriter as well, who will be helping us focus on the evolving world of specialty beers, especially wild and sour, as drinkers around the world seek out new beer experiences that increasingly occupy a place in our lives once reserved for wine. How do we talk about these beers, buy and sell them, integrate them into new bar and restaurant concepts? We'll be publishing stories in that vein shortly. We're also supported by the Fervent Few, a growing community of GBH fans, including some professional supporters. From the UK, we have Cloudwater Brew Co., Four Pure, Magic Rock, Honest Brew, Siren Craft Brew, Two Tribes, Beer Hawk, Northern Monk, Boundary Brewing in Belfast, and Ireland Craft Beers, an exporter. And in the US, we have the Mitten Bar up in Ludington, Michigan, Lord Hobo in Massachusetts, Sound Growler Brewing in Tinley Park, Illinois, 1911 Established Cider and Spirits from New York, and then there's Devil's Peak of Signal Hill Products in Cape Town, South Africa, all supporting us through their monthly pro-tier subscriptions. You can join the Fervent Few by visiting goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew. This week, we've got Hillary Schuster, our experienced director on the GBH studio team. Hillary is in charge of all the events we produce, like Uppers and Downers, under the Good Beer Hunting banner. And she works with our clients around the world to develop their own concepts and engagements with their fans. Her background in innovation planning lends a unique perspective on these things and how the beer world can think more broadly about the audiences they attract and the experiences they create for them around beer. Not only is she my business partner, but we've been married for over 6 years. This is Hillary Schuster. Listen in. Long-time listener. First time caller. It doesn't work, but you know what I mean. Welcome to your husband's podcast.
Oh, yeah, fun. It's not nerve-wracking at all.
We're only at like 160 episodes in. So, you know, it's early still.
Yeah.
You could totally be in on the upfront of this, not the tail end of it.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Fingers crossed.
Right.
Welcome.
Yeah, thanks.
You don't seem as nervous as I thought you would.
Well, we'll see.
So I brought you on today to talk about Uppers and Downers specifically, yep. but before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about your role here at Good Beer Hunting. I mean, you're co-owner.
I am co-owner.
It's a 50-50 thing.
Yeah, it started out sort of just as like an official technicality, I think.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, you were always working on it.
Yeah, I've worked on events for Good Beer Hunting and other design-related support roles, like building proposals for clients and stuff for years while I was at doing other work and stuff like that.
Yeah. And now you run, you're technically considered experience director.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean to you?
So,
because you basically made up the title.
Yeah. Well, I like the word experiences because events sound so specific, like you're really planning a specific party and a specific specific experience, but a certain kind of experience. Uppers and Downers certainly falls in an event category, whereas, you know, we have studio events sometimes that are just people coming to hang out. We really, sometimes we fake a purpose for it just to have a reason to have people
You wouldn't
around.
Be talking about whale punch, would you?
So we create these like moments for people to come and just sort of hang out, meet each other, try some beers, stuff like that. And so for me, when I say experience director, I'm really trying to facilitate people's experiences by being a host and, you know, thinking about some of those small little moments in between that sort of make people feel comfortable and make them engaged and excited to be somewhere.
Yeah, especially with something that's kind of a new idea to them.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's as simple as something like a bottle share seems. Like, for a lot of the folks that we invite in here, especially that are our neighbors, That's a really new idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so somebody being mindful that that's a new idea for somebody goes a long way.
Right. Well, the interesting thing is for some people it's a really new idea and then other people it's a really old idea. Like,
right.
How do you make that still feel special then for people who've been to like 8 million bottle shares because they've been beer nerds for a long time?
Yeah.
So, I mean, in particular, like we hosted Angry Orchard that one time for a cider meetup during CiderCon or Cider Summit, whatever it's called. And we were hosting cider nerds, which, like, I don't really know that many cider nerds. And we wanted it to feel special and unique and really showcase this product because it's so different than a lot of commercial cider. And certainly when you see a name like Angry Orchard, you imagine a certain thing. So we went out of our way to really double down on the florals that were in the space to make it feel really special and sort of staging it and using apples in like a non-cliched way to sort of remind people of the orchard and stuff like that.
Yeah. Now, a lot of that comes from your background as a designer because you've worked, you and I met sort of like working at separate innovation agencies.
Mm-hmm.
So if the idea that there's an innovation agency is news to you, we worked at two different ones in the same city.
Yeah.
They competed with each other. That's how we got to know each other through a mutual friend. Because you went to school for that.
Yeah, for design strategy.
Right. How does, give a little bit of a for folks who, that, you know, some of that might be kind of a new idea to help them understand like what it was you studied and how that connects to experience design and what you're doing now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I very specifically in school studied human-centered product design,
mm-hmm.
But my school had sort of three main focuses. One was design planning, one was communications design, and one was product design. And the same thread sort of ran through all of those is like, how do you consider the end user in particular? So everything's really focused around doing research to understand people and understand the problem.
And some people might be familiar with like human factors research if you're from the engineering
ergonomics
realm. Yeah, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But when we talk about experience, you're not just talking about that. You're talking about like behavior,
mm-hmm.
and like social expectations and like psychology of spaces and things like that too.
Totally. I mean, I actually had a class called social factors.
Yeah.
You know, like it was really studying how people interact with something, you know, and learning to understand, you know, HCI is really popular. So it's sort of like applying that to real life, human-computer interaction.
Right.
So understanding how people's expectations in a situation can either be met or circumvented, depending on sort of what you're hoping to achieve. We had one class in particular where we had to, it was the design planning class, I think. So we had to like come up with a concept, and it could be kind of anything. And my team had come up with this concept of sort of a digital bulletin board in coffee shops. So like our product was we would sell this like digital bulletin board with like a software like social networking thing behind it. And so the idea was that people could tweet to it and like post to it like live while they were in the coffee shop. They could post flyers, and you could interact with that on your, you know, mobile or whatever, but it was also in the space. And so this whole idea was around trying to uncover sort of the subconscious things that are happening to people in coffee shops. Like, what are they thinking about? Do they wish they had more interaction with people or that they knew more, but they're too afraid to ask? Stuff like that.
And this is going way back.
This was in 2003, probably.
Yeah.
Something,
I mean, this
like
is before
that.
Things even like online dating became like a big thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like,
no,
some of the behaviors and psychologies you're talking about are like what drove an entire, you know, billion-dollar industry around digital dating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that specific idea, I mean, you can think what you want about it, but our teacher, who is very famous in the innovation industry, was like, you guys should quit school right now and go invent that.
Why didn't you?
I don't know. I mean, none of us were computer programmers or anything. We were like, and it was funny because I think, so my school, the school was for designers could go there, very specifically to learn this new skill set around design planning, sort of more of a business angle on design, or people could go there who are not from the design field, but sort of like multidisciplinary. So, you know, my teammates on that team were like somebody who had like a geology degree, somebody who had a degree in English literature, stuff like that. So, I don't think we were young. I don't think we necessarily saw that as a...
Well, I mean, it still doesn't exist.
That's true.
I mean, it's been a while. But for beer geeks, they've seen a little bit of this already. Like, just in the inkling of using Untappd, there are now There's now software from Untappd that exists on TVs in brewery tap rooms now that show you, they show you the beer list, and at the bottom is a crawler where if you check into that beer and that space while you're there drinking it, your profile pops up there and shows what you mm-hmm. rated it and, you know, what you're drinking. That's like a small sort of use case of what you're describing with your cafe digital signboard.
Yeah. Specifically, Roots Pizza has something like that, where if you like tag yourself on Instagram there, it'll show up on their TV.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess there's still a chance, is what I'm saying.
It's true. But we could do it for breweries instead of coffee shops.
There you go.
You know?
So many of the things that you did back then are about watching how people behave, mm-hmm. Trying to understand, you know, unarticulated needs. This was because I was an outsider to this field that you studied. Like, yeah. I was a graduated poet with an MFA, you know, right. and I came into the field accidentally as a writer and kind of had to take a crash course in all of this. But the part that made sense to me was that we were watching how people behave, anticipating their needs, and trying to articulate things that they couldn't necessarily say they want.
Yeah.
People like Steve Jobs are famous for saying, like, consumers can't tell you what they want because they can't even imagine it. They can tell you how to make something you've already made better, that they're really good at that.
Yeah, or they can tell you how something's broken.
Right. Yeah. But it takes somebody to observe and interpret and then reflect back. And that's basically what a writer does. I mean, mm-hmm. especially a fiction writer, not so much a poet, but a fiction writer is like watching human characters in that sort of observational fish tank kind of way.
Yeah.
But I didn't know at the time that there was an entire industry built around that.
Yeah. I mean, so I think the interesting thing is that the industry really draws people who I think have always been particularly curious, who've been particularly watching, paying attention. You know, I mean, I realized early on that the way I moved through the world was not the same as everybody. It was the same as some people, but, you know, I'd be walking alongside one of my high school girlfriends and a person would pass us by and we'd be able to describe every single thing about that person. And, like, they didn't say anything to us. We didn't, you know, we just saw them. Whereas I'd be walking with another friend and you'd be like, oh my gosh, did you see that guy's outfit? And they'd be like, what guy? You know, just nothing. So it's just, I think the industry really attracts people who are curious, pay attention, see details, and then try to draw conclusions from those things. And I think I was doing that well before I went to school for it. You know.
Do you feel lucky that you ended up in that role?
Ended up in that role in life?
Yeah. I mean, if you're somebody who was already naturally built that way, like, do you feel like you won the lottery by finding your way into that industry? Or do you think it would have gone into something equally as interesting, but totally different? Like, are there other realms that you found that to be useful in?
I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, for years I thought, like, do I want to do, like, I actually found my education, the specific schooling, not super interesting or valuable. It seemed like they were just telling you things you already sort of knew. I found the networking and friends I made incredibly valuable, and then ended up in a job for 11 years that was like a company very tied to the school and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, for a long time I was like, I don't want to do this. Like, there's, you know, certainly a part of innovation that's a little soul-sucking in that you're working often for large corporations trying to come up with, like, the next hot thing, and it gets a little tiring. And I would be like, oh, I don't want to do this. And I would sit and I would think, well, what do I want to do? Like, what are the things I like to do? And I like to tell people why they're wrong. And I like to tell people why my idea is better than theirs. So I sort of stayed in the industry because it seemed like that was the job. My old boss used to describe the job as having to tell people that their baby was ugly. Mm. Like, you would have to go into a company and be like, yeah, there's a reason why you're not being successful at this. Mm. And so I tended to do that through design, you know, telling stories and showcasing ideas through, like, a better visual representation of that than existed before.
And I always found it fascinating the amount of different skill sets that people like yourself would rely on in order to tell those stories.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you were sometimes writing, sometimes illustrating. You were designing slides and decks to bring, you know, to kind of bring all that to life,
uh-huh.
Communications design. And sometimes you were physically prototyping things,
yep.
you know, out of paper, out of wood, out of electronics, like, whatever. Sometimes you were building interfaces to show how that thing would actually work in real life. If, you know, it was an unbelievable amount of different skills. But everybody that I met in the industry when I first started that was like you was just like, well, how else would you do it?
Right.
You just got to make the thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, the interesting thing is, so what is the... what ties back to what I do here was that the thing I sort of found the most enjoyment in was workshop planning. So, you know, in innovation and consulting in general, you often have meetings with clients and you have them throughout the course of a project. Some kinds of design and consulting, you have like a kickoff one and then you have the final delivery one and that's it. But in innovation, we typically have lots of client check-ins if we're not even co-located with the client and co-working with the client. So we would have a, you know, an initial kickoff, then we'd have a research share out, like after we did the round of research, then there would be a concept share out, and then there'd be a refinement one. And so there would be all these check-ins. And I would often help build the decks for that so that the team, my team, which I was not on the project, but my team would go and we would work together to build the deck that they would share with the client. I would help build worksheets and workbooks and other materials that the client would engage with in order to help elicit more information, help frame the idea themselves.
Frameworks, tools, all sorts of stuff.
And so then, but then in addition to that, it would often be things like name tags and, you know, posters and different things that would sort of like raise the level of engagement, sort of make them feel like this was special, interesting, cool, they're a part of it. So I found the most fun projects were things where I was really trying to like build an experience. What are the little like knickknack, like, you know, notebooks or pens or whatever that the clients are going to get when they show up. Sometimes those things are super branded, sometimes they're not.
That's a pretty good description as somebody who's watched you build something like Uppers and Downers, from the really high level kind of ideas all the way down to like the tiny little things that you interact with.
Mm-hmm.
Like that seems pretty transportable for you, like what you brought from that kind of a role and that kind of career into designing beer festivals, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of a crazy connection, but that's essentially the bridge that you've crossed now.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I've been to plenty of beer festivals where, like, you go and you get some tiny little ugly glass that you don't care about, and then you get to drink beer. And you often get to drink great beer, but that's it. It's crowded, and you have to wait in line, and, you know, it's only worth it if the product is really good.
That's enough for a lot of people.
Totally.
I mean, they clearly, you know, in droves are still going to these things.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you think, so what's the problem there in your mind? If they're still pretty well populated, even if you know, in your view, they're pretty, you know, simple and mm-hmm. maybe not developed in an interesting way for you, like what's missing then?
Well, I don't know, a couple of things. I mean, one, I think it's no fun for the breweries. Mm. I mean, you know, part of my audience in this are the brewers. You know, we have good relationships with them, friends. I want them to be excited. So I want them to feel good about... Well, so first of all, some festivals have volunteers pouring. So that's not really our thing. You know, we've long defined the idea that beer for us is really about the people. So for the fests that we do and the events that we do, the brewers are always there and always present. And so designing an experience for them where they get to engage with people for a little longer than... a pour, like they can talk to people, there's more space to move, they get to hang out with each other, they're excited about the beers they're pouring because they're very unique. So they're one audience that I'm really trying to design something cool for, and that extends to sort of the signage and the programming where I want them to feel really showcased. The programs that we make are big booklets. They include descriptions of the beers, some longer than others. Really.
Some are really long.
So some have to get edited down. Salmouth. So we really try to, you know, highlight the fact that it's important to us that they're putting out this cool product. And then I also think that the best beer festivals are going to be ones that appeal to wider audiences. Mm. So some of the... You know, one of the popular ones in the city is the Wells Park one, and that's because it's really wide open. Families can go. It appeals to the community very specifically, not just beer people. So for me, with Uppers and Downers, number one, obviously it appeals to coffee people, so that's exciting. We bring in a whole separate craft subculture. And then it also, I think, just appeals to anyone who, like, I don't know, likes fun, cool, interesting, beautiful experiences. You know, there's room to move, room to talk to people. There's lots of places to take a break when it's crowded. Like a lot of fests you're just at and you're in it. But at Thalia Hall, we have this big balcony that people can go sit in. And
I love sitting up there and just like people watching while I drink a nice 4 ounce pour of something beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, when do you get to sit down at a beer fest? Not that often. No. So there's space to kind of relax and, you know, take pictures and take notes. The program, you can check stuff off. There's little check boxes. So I don't know. I think I just, maybe in that I'm designing for myself. I'm, you know, almost 40 years old. And when I go somewhere, I don't want to just be crowded and uncomfortable. I want to be able to like take time to reflect on why I'm there. And
yeah, you're not a 25-year-old man who's, you know, satisfied with a little 2 ounce shot glass with a logo on it and standing around in line with your friends and drinking in line and then getting another one, which is fine for a lot of people.
Again, I don't want that to sound like there's anything wrong with it.
What's missing is a whole huge group of people that would love to take part in like a really interesting beer, culinary, coffee kind of experience that is not enough for. It's just not interesting to them.
Yeah.
And I think that's in my experience, I think one of the things that you've been really great at is defining what the beer experience can be in a way that far exceeds my own beer nerd experience as a middle-aged white guy that's gone to a million festivals.
Yeah.
I found myself not going to as many anymore, but I wasn't necessarily self-reflecting on why.
Right.
And when I walk into Uppers and Downers, because now I almost get to be a guest because you run from top to bottom now. I just get to walk into this thing where I'm just like, this is so different. It's so different than what I'm used to experiencing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a little hard to articulate why it's so different, but it's very different. I mean,
aesthetically. Aesthetically, the layers that you've put in there of, you know, like the raw wood combined with a bunch of greenery and flowers. Like, it's just like this really nice, warm combination of things.
Mm-hmm.
The brewers always look super happy to be there. Like, they can't wait for people to come in that door.
Yeah.
They all get to hang out at one long table rather than be isolated by 10-foot by 10-foot tents like they are at other beer festivals.
Right, you know? True. They're all
which serve a functional purpose, but actually accidentally isolate people. And they just like they're stuck with their 2 or 3 man crew all day long pouring beers for the same people, and they don't get to hang out with each other so easily.
Right.
So much of that I think is just you considering behavior and human needs, even if they're not articulated.
Right. Yeah.
I just find it fascinating.
Awesome.
What were you going to say?
I was just thinking about, this sounds a little pandering, but about how many women we have at the fest. Mm. And, you know, I think increasingly you're seeing tons and tons more women at all of beer events.
Yep.
But we definitely have a good amount of women at Uppers and Downers, I think partly because of coffee. There's a lot of women in coffee. And then, you know, yeah, it's just...
It's noticeably different.
It's noticeably different.
Yeah. And I think we see a wider spread of age groups than I'm used to seeing at beer events as well.
True. We definitely get an older crowd than some fests.
Yeah. Yeah. You've also, I mean, you do this same kind of thing for some of our clients. I mean, one of your biggest projects in the past couple of months, even running alongside Uppers and Downers, has been East Brothers, first anniversary party. East Brothers, mm-hmm. a client of ours out in Richmond, California, that we developed the brand for. We helped name them. We helped, you know, we work with them every day to some degree, whether mm-hmm. it's on the brewing side or the marketing side or design and sales. And you've been working on this anniversary party, and we created, I remember we had this one call with them where we were outlining like all these potential different ideas for events in the tap room, because they really wanted to like ramp up on that this year. Like, that was a goal of theirs. And instead of having a disparate set of events that they were always kind of scrambling to build and have new ideas and have to like, you know, all the lift that comes with a new idea, we kind of gave them one big idea
mm-hmm.
that had some variability under it, and it's called Rec Room.
Yeah, sort of a branded concept.
Yeah, tell us more about that and how you approached it.
Yeah, so I mean, East Brother in general draws a pretty wide crowd, I think, and they have a built-in bocce court outside, mm-hmm. and they have cornhole that they play, known as bags to other people. Seems to be a regional thing. And then they have a ping pong table, and they now have a pool table. And so
they were kind of naturally becoming known for having these like small recreational things.
Yeah, because you could go and hang out and play games. And so we just decided to double down on that and sort of, you know, build out that concept even more. So we did that through the actual games themselves. They built a little shelf system and got a bunch of board games. And then they worked with somebody locally who will put arcade games in your space, and then they maintain them and they get the money from them. You're just sort of the space for them. Mm-hmm. So they now have a pinball machine in there and like a retro 80s gamer, one of those newer things where you can play different games on it. And so we doubled down on it by adding more things and then building out this concept for like a mug club membership club, where instead of just having a mug that hangs on a wall and you come in on a certain day or any day and you get to drink slightly cheaper out of it, we created a night that's sort of a combination of that with like a bowling league. So every Wednesday night you can come in and there will be a special glassware that you drink out of, and you get a t-shirt for signing up, and you have a member card. And when you come in, you get a little scorecard for that night, and as you play games, you, whether you win or lose, you get some points, and then that builds a leaderboard over time. And if you hit certain thresholds, you get, you know, a coupon for a free pint, or you get 50% off a piece of merch. So as you go, you can earn points.
So it reminds me of like the scoreboard that I would see in bowling leagues, where like mm-hmm. people's names were on there or the team name was on there, and every week I would see them adjusting. I have a lot of nostalgia for that personally, just because I grew up going to bowling, bowling alleys and seeing the leagues and just thinking like, wow, how do you get in a league?
Yeah.
Like, I remember it just being like really fascinating to me. So that's pretty interesting. What I liked about that final concept was, there's a certain amount of nostalgia built into the East Brother brand, because so much of it is based on it being like an old manufacturing town. They're right on the port. They're in the midst of the freighters and trains. And they're very much like part of that, the fabric of that city's history that way, as a small manufacturer themselves. And so now bringing in the sort of event concept that kind of plays off of that kind of history and those same kind of ideas, but making it feel really relevant to a young and old audience is really interesting to me. I love the illustrations that you and Cooper worked on for the posters. They're kind of reflecting, like, all the characters in those posters have a little bit of that kind of nostalgic vibe to them. Even the clothes they're wearing are, like, slightly dated looking if you look closely.
Yeah.
It just looks really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it also has a little bit of a nod to almost, like, one of those, like, VFW hall kind of things. Like, I'm imagining as more and more people, you know, join in and start coming on Wednesday nights, it's going to have this, like, really strong, like, community vibe that I think is really important to them for the area that they're in. And so, in addition to the leagues that are going to start happening every Wednesday starting the 14th, 2 weeks, 1 week, and they're also having their annual rec room party, which they did for the first time a year ago, largely based around the idea that they had a ping pong table. And
it's a little more robust now.
Yes. And so they're having their annual rec room party, which they're also using to celebrate their anniversary, which was back in December, but they've now been open like a year and a quarter. And so they'll be, you know, doing other fun community things there. They have food and music and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So we built some cool anniversary-related swag. There's, like, some koozies that you get if you come and buy plates.
It's got a trophy on it.
Uh-huh. So then I think that the thought is that at the next rec room party, we'll have had a year's worth of leagues and scores and stuff, and so people can
play in
playoffs.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't wait for that.
Yeah.
Another good example of this sort of experience design background of yours coming into play for one of our clients with Stony Creek.
Mm-hmm.
So they just announced, and then we followed up with a blog post of our own on our studio blog, that they're putting in a fully functioning brew pub in the Foxwoods Resort and Casino in Connecticut, which is a massive 9 million square foot, you know, complex. And we're going to have a small little brew pub in there, which is exciting. But a big piece of that was us getting together as a team and thinking about, like, what is the experience of that brew pub, not only from the inside of it, which, you know, I think most people who are, you know, in the beer world can kind of tell you what a brew pub could or should feel like.
Mm-hmm.
But we were in the unique, the unique situation of being in a giant casino.
Right.
And so that just changes the context of everything.
Yeah.
And that brainstorm was really exciting for me, because everybody on the team and the way that you led them with sort of a framework for thinking about the space, like, really started to think about it in contrast to a casino. Like, we had all these, like, outdoors concepts that came
like
into that.
Like a respite from all the chaos of the casino.
Totally. Yeah. And to me, I think that was a great example of how thinking contextually and about, you know, what the psychology and the social sort of expectations in a space like a casino can do if you're paying attention to them. Because those behavioral patterns change what your opportunities are.
Right.
And I thought that was really fascinating. That to me was one of our more complex experience plans.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, thinking through sort of, you know, that we did, unlike in traditional innovation, we didn't go and do a bunch of research. We didn't like go hang out at Foxwoods and like interview people or anything like
right.
that.
Yeah. But it was more observational than
more
anything.
More observational, yeah. But really thinking through like, what do we feel like people need in that kind of environment and how are you really going to draw people in.
Yeah, how are you going to be different than the cocktail-driven dessert place owned by the Kardashians across the concourse? Because that's your direct competition.
Yeah.
So you got to be a little different than that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, with your background, having spent 11 years in innovation planning and then moved over into the beer world full-time, which, I mean, you've been working for Good Beer Hunting full-time for almost 2 years now,
almost.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
How is it the same? How is it different for you? Like, what's that transition been like to be thinking about? You've essentially just adopted one industry and you're going super deep.
Yeah, I get that, but I don't really think about it that way at all. I mean, I'm not thinking about beer when I'm planning these events. Like, and I don't mean that to be dismissive of, you know, sort of the product that everybody works really hard on and that I obviously love and care about a lot. But the event itself, like, in my, for me, when I'm planning things, someone else is taking care of the product. They're bringing their, you know, fantastic, unique, showcase-worthy product to my event. So for me, I'm not really focused as much on the beer as sort of everything surrounding it. And so that doesn't really feel that much different. I don't typically feel like I'm focused on one thing. Mm. And, you know, while beer used to have a stereotypical audience, like a very specific person you'd be designing for. That's not true anymore. So the people that I'm planning these events for aren't unique to beer, I don't think, you know? I think there's a certain passion that's unique that you find in some other industries, but not all. But other than that, you know, it's pretty diverse and so I'm thinking about the people and sort of how they'll experience the beer, not the beer itself.
So it still feels pretty broad to you then?
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the events we plan are super broad. So Uppers and Downers is, you know, on the coffee side too. And then we plan Ali Ali every fall, which is more of a private thing. But it's a camp event for people in the culinary world, a lot of our design friends, beer people. It's super wide ranging in terms of age and, you know, sex and people and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, and then our clients too, you know, their audiences are all different. And so I don't know. I don't really think about it.
So I guess when you describe it that way, it sounds like the context actually shifts a lot more than it does if you just think about them all as beer events.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't, when I'm planning something like Ali Ali, which is our camp weekend, you know, the beer is often, I mean, we don't tend to focus on the product. It's way more about like having a beer together than having a beer. And like, it's way more about having a beer in the woods than having a beer. So, certainly in that context, there's so much more around this sort of nostalgia that I'm planning for and planning for, you know, people making new friends. It's like really specific to that kind of immersive camp environment.
It rained on you this year.
All my chalkboards. it rained a lot. It could have been worse. We like, nobody realized how worse it could have been. Apparently like one town over, they were getting like golf ball sized hail and we managed to avoid that. It was just, you know, it rained really hard a couple times, but we were fine.
We still got to eat outside under the tent. We still got to hang out in the lodge. We still got to do a lot of things. Sorry.
It's fine.
I know it was a great deal of loss for you.
Yeah. No, I'm just, well, so, I mean, part of what he's referring to is like, you know, each year I try to make stuff a little different and unique. And because if you're always doing an event in the same location, like Uppers and Downers, we always have it at Thalia Hall. And Ali Ali, we always do it up at Camp Wendawega. And we have a lot of returning guests. I don't want it to feel like the same experience every time. And so there's always a balance of what stuff's dialed in enough that we don't want to mess with it because it means that like producing it runs like a machine in a very efficient way, an effective way.
You get to hang out more rather than just like work so hard.
Right. Versus how do you make it unique every time and fun for everybody and stuff like that. And so for this year at Ali Ali, one of the things I wanted to do was serve lunch off the deck of the treehouse where people would kind of file up, get their lunch, and then go sit on the lawn, sort of surrounding the treehouse on blankets and stuff like that.
That would have been so nice.
Oh, it wouldn't have been. It would have been so nice. But we could not. And then I also wanted to do the dinner not under the tent. Mm. I wanted the dinner to feel actually, so there's a big mess hall tent at camp and we have most of our meals under it. And
it's like just big enough for 50 people.
Just, yeah. And it's like green and white stripes, sort of like nostalgic, campy looking. And we have all of our meals under it almost always. I wanted to move, so in this case, I wanted to move lunch away from it. And then I also wanted to move the main showcase beer dinner away from it and do that under the stars with like lights overhead. Hmm. So we did not get to do that.
No, that would have been nice though with the, because it was dim sum and then it was a low country boil from, or Lao country boil with Laotian sausage from Bavana.
Yeah.
They drove it all the way up from North Carolina.
Yeah. Anyways, that's fine. Everything's fine.
I thought it was beautiful.
It was beautiful.
So I think one of my favorite parts about camp is that you do have to adjust to, you know, the climate of what's happening there because, you know, we do it in October, which means it could either be really warm or it could be bitterly cold. We've had some nights that fall into the 20s.
Right.
And some people are sleeping in teepees. And so that's a real factor.
Right. Well, the cool thing about camp is that while I'm planning this event and sort of throwing it for 50 people, we're sort of all throwing it together once we're up there. So it's super collaborative. Everybody's helping wash dishes. People are helping to move tables. So when it's raining, everybody's helping to solve that problem and stuff like that. So it's really fun. It's very different than, you know, Uppers and Downers, which is I have a small production team of people helping me, but more or less, you know, we're throwing an event for people.
Yeah, including the brewers. We try to, I mean, one of the things we do is we design the draft system, or Gary Valentine, our collaborator on that, designs the draft system. He does the draft system for FOBAB as well. That's just like completely managed for brewers. There's no jockey boxes. There's no CO2 tanks they've got to worry about. Their stuff's already on ice, kegged, tapped when they get there. They just have to show up and pour.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I've noticed that because of how easy it is for them, they interact with drinkers more. They interact with each other more.
Right.
You know, they're willing to like pass it off to the person behind them and go walk around for a few minutes and get to know the rest of what's being poured there and kind of soak it all in. And you know, and their roasters are able to pour. We've made it so simple that their roaster collaborators sometimes stand with them and pour the beers themselves because nobody's worried about how to maintain the system in any way.
Right.
And it just kind of frees people up to like be able to take credit for the things that they made and talk about them and not worry about the facilitation of it. That's always been pretty cool.
Yeah.
What are your what are the things you're most excited about Uppers and Downers this year? Is it all of the things? Because there's a whole week of events.
There's a whole week of events, yeah. So the whole...
I should say, what are you terrified of this year?
The whole week of events. No, so we've added a couple events to the week leading up to Uppers and Downers. In particular, there's a charity dinner the night before. So we're going to be hosting 100 people. Tickets are still available. In the Thalia Hall space with most of the fest setup already having taken place the night before. So we're going to be working with Deucex, which Thalia Hall is our partner on the fest. And so we're going to be working with Deucex, Kevin Hickey from Duckin, Jason Hamill from Lula, the culinary director of Frontera Group, and Mindy Siegel from Hot Chocolate.
It's a killer list.
Yeah.
And it's like an unbelievable list.
Yeah. And pairing all of their courses with a few of our case study partners and sponsors from the fest.
Right. Breweries. You're talking about breweries.
Yeah. Breweries. Yeah. Breweries and Powers Whiskey.
That's right. Yeah.
So there'll be like welcome cocktail, welcome drinks, and then beers paired with each of the courses. And so that'll be like a sit-down dinner, you know, five courses.
I mean, it's nuts. It's going to be huge. I'm looking at this as a beer geek for a second.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy to me that we're going to have a beer dinner with all of those chefs lined up. And that some of the beers that are going to be paired with them are people like Burial and Bavana, you know, people from far outside of town that do not distribute to Chicago. So not only are they going to be in, you know, those beers being paired with dishes with some of our best chefs, but all together. I don't know. It's exciting to me.
Yeah, I think it'll be a really cool experience. And, you know, similar to the fest in that, you know, things are very considered and it's very, you know, thoughtful and designed experience. But obviously the food will be a huge showcase at that. And then all the profits of that are going to be going to the Pilsen Food Pilsen Food Pantry. Easy for me to see. Oh my gosh. down in the neighborhood where we're hosting the fest and the dinner.
Right. It's going to benefit the neighborhood.
Right. And then we're also doing a preview event, a little, you know, just tap takeover kind of style event at Public and Anchor on Thursday night.
That's called Decaf.
Mm-hmm, because we're basically, as Uppers and Downers has grown and started to attract people from outside our market, they have to get temporary distribution to come to the fest. And so people like...
Which is, it costs time and money to do that.
Yeah. So somebody like Brewery Bavana and Burial Brewing, who are bothering to send teams up here, they're getting temporary distribution up here all to participate in the fest. They are going to bring some non-coffee beers, some stuff from their regular...
Stuff that kind of defines who they are. It's a good chance for them to come to Chicago and make a small splash while they're here.
Yeah, so we'll be doing that on Thursday night.
Yeah.
And then Wednesday, we're doing two different coffee events, a roaster tour, and then a hands-on demo with learning how to pull an espresso shot with La Marzocca.
Mm-hmm. That'll be at Revival.
That'll be at Revival Food Hall. And then the roaster tour kicks off at Metric, goes Metric, Passion House, Intelligentsia, and Counterculture.
And Counterculture, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And then Tuesday night, we're doing the cocktail competition, which we've actually done for several years. And that's at Tack Room with some of the best bartenders around the city.
Is it true that there are 500 RSVPs for that already?
There's a lot of RSVPs. I'm not sure. That number could be exaggerated, but there are a lot of RSVPs for the cocktail event.
I'm a little nervous about it.
So if it's not your thing, I would suggest skipping that. But it'll be...
Come to the dinner or the fest instead.
Yes. The cocktail thing will be really fun. We're doing Irish coffee cocktails again this year.
It's a blast. Every bartender has like their own little station where they're presenting, you know, their concept. And they make it for you on the spot. And they kind of, you know, they dress up their station in sort of the concept sometimes, you know, with like accoutrement and like the tapestries that they put out on over the tables, and they kind of take over their small space. So it ends up becoming, I mean, it's like an adult science fair.
Yeah.
It's really amazing.
That's a good description. And so this year it'll be the Irish coffee, which typically is a very specific thing, but the kind of the point of the thing is that everybody does their own sort of interpretation on it.
Yeah.
Some are more classic, some are more out there.
Yeah, it's super cool. It's one of my favorite things we do. And then the winner gets to pour their cocktail at the festival.
Right. So at the fest, if you're coming to the fest, the main bar on the main floor will be serving the winner's cocktail.
So if you don't already realize, you need to take your entire week off.
Yeah.
Or at least your evenings and join us for a ton of Uppers and Downers stuff this year. It's basically its own beer week.
Yeah. Hangover parties on Sunday at Hopewell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you can't even remember them all now.
No, I know.
Are you feeling good about it?
I am. I'm excited. I think the case studies are going to be super fun. We have more case studies than ever.
Yep. Three per session.
We have three case studies per
plus
session.
Plus special exhibits with Guinness.
Yep. And some people are doing some like crazy stuff. Cruz Blanca's bringing like 7 beers for their case study.
Yeah, it's going to be killer. They shared one with me that had... it was a coffee stout with some raspberry and something else in there. I think it was called Magnolia. I might be misremembering the name that went with that beer. They gave me a sample of it. It was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I mean, the descriptions that are coming in are just awesome. Yeah. I mean,
and you're tweeting them out.
I am. I'm tweeting them out. But yeah, if anyone hasn't been before, the sort of the cool thing is that you have a certain perception of what a coffee beer is. It's like dark and roasty and chocolatey, but tons of people are doing like crazy stuff, you know, really bright and light.
Well, even Guinness, who is known for their stout, and that's about it, is not making a stout. They're making a Belgian triple.
Right.
Which is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're bringing some of their stouts to taste kind of in a taste test side by side as sort of a flavor like experience. And then they're bringing,
a coffee Belgian triple.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. Yeah. That they make in their new brewery in Maryland.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be a wild year. Every year I get nervous that we've already topped out and it can't get more interesting.
Yeah.
And every year somebody, like last year, Four Letter Word and Weiner brought like a lactic fermentation coffee blended into a Belgian dark ale. And like, what?
Yeah.
So every year there's always like a half a dozen things that I can't believe exist.
I know. Brewery Bavana is doing a really cool thing because they're taking just their stem saison, for the specific part of their case study. They're taking the stem saison and they're doing it with Ethiopian coffee and then coffee from Burundi and wash process versus natural process. So there's four different ones.
Oh, that's cool.
Where you can taste sort of the variety across the two different coffee regions and then the washed versus natural.
Killer. And that's all counterculture.
Yes, all counterculture coffee.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, we thank you for your service.
Yeah. Oh, you can also come see us in London, May 19th.
May 19th, Uppers and Downers, London.
My other note.
It'll be exciting to go back there and do that again.
Yeah.
You've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
Do you, any regrets leaving the old job for this one?
I miss the alone time.
Am I just around too much? Is that the problem?
It's a little too much. I used to have my commute to myself to read books. This job is a lot more work than my old job, but a lot more rewarding. So it's 50-50.
Thanks for listening this week, folks. If you enjoyed listening to Hillary, you can find her in the Fervent Few, our member community. Become a subscriber, join the group, pick her brain. We're all in there. To join, go to goodbeerhunting.com/ferventview. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.